Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of the Crate and Crowbar, all about tabletop role-playing games. I know we just said that one-off podcasts are literally what we're not going to be doing, but it's not every day that you launch a Kickstarter for a role-playing book, and that is something that I, Marsh Davis, have in fact just done. And it seems like the best possible excuse to talk about a subject I love with some chums. And those chums are as follows. My partner in podding, a Nice Games writerman and esteemed contributor to one of our previous role-playing games, Jamie Britton.
Yahar.
My co-creator in all things role-playing, the visionary Dreamweaver, Jim Rossignol.
I am the Dreamweaver.
And fellow TTRPG creator and co-host of the Strange Studies of Strange Stories podcast, Chris Lackey.
I'm a pirate.
Thank you all for joining me.
Marsh, congratulations on kickstarting Gold Teeth, the follow-up to Teeth.
Thank you. That was a wonderful segue, allowing me to talk self-servingly about the book that we've just launched. It's called Gold Teeth, and it's a game of piracy and occult horror set in a cursed corner of the Caribbean in the year of 1781, in fact. And it's a sequel to the last book we launched, which was called Teeth, but it's completely standalone. It's got loads of new rules to enable your group to cooperatively control sail ships and do battle with sail ships and crash sail ships and probably sink sail ships. And you'll also go to land as well. You'll be pleased to know where you'll shank spies in the back alleys of seedy ports and sabotage caches of gunpowder and sneak into fancy balls and burn down governor's mansions and so forth. All the good things, basically, that you love and require in role-playing settings, all in aid of finding some measure of redemption before a pirate curse twists you beyond all human recognition and claims your soul. I think that is the top line of the role-playing game. Does that sound about right, Jim? Is there anything else that I've missed that you're most excited about with Gold Teeth?
That's very good. No, that's a very, very good summary. People regularly go straight to, so what game system is it? And it is an adaptation of Forged in the Dark, which is the rule set that was derived from The Wonderful Blades in the Dark by John Harper, which is a system that we've used before and adapted for five different standalone things now.
Six.
Okay. If you say so, six different standalone things now that we have made under the Teeth moniker, all of which have been very well received, I think. And so we're excited to move on to this one because you really like big cannons and beards.
Nautical shit. That's what I'm into.
As research for this episode, I listened back to the very good podcast you guys did a couple of years back about tabletop RPGs in general. And one of the things that came up on that was, Jim, I think you were talking about a particular game which had the... I think you were talking about not being able to play it or perhaps not being able to get a game off the ground, which involved like crewing a starship, that particular fantasy where you'd have people manning different stations. It might have been in relation to the Rogue Trader Warhammer game, I think. And I was just thinking about an early version of the rules I saw, which have your kind of ship crewing sort of system in here, which I think looks really awesome and really interesting. Is that kind of coming from a similar kind of place for you? Was that part of the sort of reasoning behind this game was to do that fantasy?
I think no, actually. I think I still have the spaceship thing from another direction. But this definitely came from Marsh's slightly unhinged interest in sail ships and nautical adventures. For me, this was quite unexpected because Marsh just turned around eventually and said, well, you know what's in this setting, don't you? Pirates and sail ships and all that stuff. And I was like, huh? But it turns out he'd been reading an exciting book series of nautical adventures, which had inspired and excited him. And then we went almost straight to working on rules for it before we'd done anything else. Like, usually we're a bit settingy, we're a bit, you know, coming up with funny characters and funny stories, but no, we went straight in with how would ships work in this kind of rule set. But no, spaceships still to come. We'll do Space Teeth.
Space Teeth is that's a really good title.
I know I'm a bit thick, but it just dawned on me that Gold Teeth, your first game is called Teeth. It didn't even occur to me at all.
Does gold teeth speak to you of pirates, though? That's the thing.
Absolutely.
Because we said, is that a pirate pun, or are we just imagining it? Because imagine if we put it out and it wasn't, you know, that wasn't a pirate trope, we'd look really stupid. But you know, turns out people get it, and it is, so that's good.
So what was the series of books, Marsh? Was it the Aubrey Maturin? Is that, am I saying that right?
Those, yes. Yeah, the Master and Commander series of books by Patrick O'Brien. I went on a stag do in Holland and over imbibed one evening, and then in my hotel room as I was recovering, I bought the entire series on Kindle, and I haven't actually regretted that. It's been fantastic. I've read them all, 25 or something books of them, and they are fantastic. Exciting books full of daring do, but also like incredibly rich personalities, amazing contemporary detail for that era. But also the hallmark of them is that I have so enjoyed them and so loved the kind of experience of naval combat and naval antics that they give you. And yet by the end of the series, I had not learned a single fucking thing about ships. I couldn't tell you what any of the sails were or where the different bits of the boat are. Those books have communicated to me a rich and deep love and interest and understanding of the kind of the dynamics of that kind of situation. And so that's what I wanted to do with the rules in Gold Teeth, is that have players be able to reenact these exciting and distinctly nautical adventures without necessarily needing to know the physics of how sail ships work. Don't know that we've achieved that. It seems quite hard work in our current play tests, but you know, that's fine. I'm interested parties will get a lot out of it, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the things to note, and people will already have inferred this from Marsh's ramble there, is that we're massive history nerds, and all of the teeth stuff has kind of spoken of our interest in that era and in history generally. We did one that was out almost sort of out of sequence, which was False Kingdom, which is a medieval setting but with connections in the ludicrous timeline we wrote for the original. It's just fun to take the ludicrousness of actual history and try and kind of connect it to these games. And I think we've wrestled to an extent with, Marsh wrote something about this recently on our newsletter about, you know, wrestling with being not necessarily historically accurate, but like faithful to the history, and to the extent that we can do that in something that has monsters and ludicrousness. And yeah, I think that as much as that is true in the setting and narrative and fiction and storytelling and characters and the existence of monsters and magic and so on, that's also probably true for the rules, in that you're going to have a good time piloting these ships, but it might not be. My sister, who is a very enthusiastic sailor, saw the diagram that we posted and went, oh, well, it's not quite like that. And then sent me like a bunch of annotated. And I expect there's going to be a lot of that as we go forward.
Yeah.
One of the things I loved about the setting of the first Teeth, right, was that because it was, you know, basically Stalker in Yorkshire, right? you know, you had the kind of the real worldness of kind of, you know, the area of the setting generally, right? So that stuff's fairly easy to kind of simulate. But the fact that you had basically a hellmouth zone in the center there, that kind of felt like it was a really good incitement to create and play around, and anything that you got wrong kind of historically was like easy to hand wave because like, oh, a wizard did it, you know. Is that something you're sort of looking at with Gold Teeth as well, that kind of ability to be a bit muddy with the stuff that that players might come up with?
Yes. So we've sort of, it is set in the Caribbean broadly, but it's a fictional archipelago. In the same way that Teeth sort of carves out or recreates a whole new 100-mile stretch of land that exists somewhere in the north of England, but doesn't really. We've created a new area within the Caribbean. So we just wanted to give ourselves enough fictional distance that we could play around with things that were true to the time, but then that don't appropriate you know, the stories of other real people in a way which would be really harmful. but we've definitely tried to recreate some of the things that were successful in Teeth. So like that whole thing where you're in a zone, you know, and there's a time limit. There's a kind of potboiler sense to Teeth where things are going to get worse for you personally across the course of a year. And you're in this confined space. You're trapped there with a bunch of whole other people. And we found reasons to recreate that in the new setting as well, where an occult weapon has detonated and created this massive encircling wall of water, which has trapped all of these warring colonial navies within it, basically. And you are deposited there to do malicious work on the behalf of King George III, but it's under false pretenses. As in the first game, you have your own agenda, which runs contrary to that of the English crown, and that will slowly emerge and pit you against the colonial forces across the course of the game as you seek your own form of redemption. But yeah, that was important to us to get both the confinement and the kind of the time pressure as well as creating like a fictional landscape that we can take more liberties with than we would if it was completely based on history.
It sounds fantastic. And like, one of the problems I think a lot of RPG games come with, especially when they kind of take place in a world that is anyway open, I've kind of encountered this quite a few times, and playing with playing in a game, we can talk about this later maybe, but like I played in a game with Chris of the kind of Alien RPG, which is like a really brilliant setting when you're near an alien, but actually once you've run away from the alien and you're kind of like, what should we do next? And they've come up with this sumptuously detailed, you know, version of the Alien universe, which they've based on all of the movies and all of the other properties. But you don't really have a reason to be there, right, Chris? Like, you said you played one game where everyone just sort of collected their kind of earnings, and then, like, you all just agreed as a group that was the end of the story.
Well, one of the groups that you're supposed to play, it's like space truckers, colonial marines, or colonists. So we were a group of space truckers, but a space trucker is a person that's doing a job trying to make a living. So if you run into some aliens, like, why the hell would you ever deal with them ever again? You would want to get as far away from that as you possibly could. There's no motivation for it, really. I mean, they could offer you money, but why would they offer a space trucker more money to go do a thing? Like, it just didn't make any sense.
So yeah, that's why I loved that Teeth, like, you're given a really, really specific mission that you can pick from a list, and also a kind of secret mission. In fact, you've got sort of three missions, right? You've got your mission from the king to kind of, you know, go and do something, and then you've got the secret mission of the group, and then you can have your personal missions too. And the fact that you have, like, clocks in Teeth, I think is, it really helps set the structure of play, and I think a lot of games sort of don't bother with that. Mm-hmm. Often because I think they're expecting you to just run their campaigns or run their modules. But I mean, like, Teeth is the kind of game where you're prompting players to do crazy shit, right? So you need to find that structure in other ways.
Yeah, we found a similar sort of thing in our recent game of Mothership, where at least I was paralyzed by a sort of difficulty with seizing the adventure, you know, accepting the call to adventure, because the call to adventure is a call to suicide, basically, in Mothership. And unless you're a character who has incredibly strong motivations to throw themselves right into the maw of death, then you're going to struggle to convincingly roleplay a psychology which would explain why they would do something so counter to their self-interest. There's lots of ways to do that, I think, but I think it's easier. And Mothership, I think, asks quite a lot of the GM and the players to do that work on its behalf. Whereas I think we've baked in quite a lot of that pressure and that direction into Teeth and Gold Teeth. So that,
well, I think it was Chris made a good point, just slightly further back there, saying that a lot of those systems expect to run their modules and their adventures. And I think that's very, very true of the Mothership stuff. So we sort of bounced off it initially, and we've been playing it recently on the insistence of Quentin Smith from Quinn's Quest, because he was very much like, no, you must play these different modules because they're all fantastic and they teach you to play it and they're an incredible showcase of it. And you can experience stuff in terms of learning the system and running it, and they're very structured, and you know there's just great writing material and stuff in there. And I think he's right, and that is true of a whole bunch of systems where the heart of it is running these fantastic modules that people have created. And what I would say is, we rarely do that. We rarely run modules or other people's adventures.
Yeah.
We don't tend to play games where you would be expecting to pick up a module and then run it, which I think is quite a different way of approaching RPGs than is traditional. And certainly a lot of people rely on and run pre-existing adventures. Whereas I don't really do that as a GM. We've never really done that as a group. So when we came to writing a game, it had to have all of that stuff in there, it had to have all the GM prompts, it had to have all the stuff for the players to know. They can just look straight at their page and go, oh yeah, so this is my motivation and these are the things I can do, rather than find out how these mad characters end up doing something tonight and seeing what they do.
Mm.
And so I think the way we've played and run games over the years has ended up feeding into what we've ended up making in terms of how the Teeth books work.
Yes, and I think if I may blow some smoke, like I think you've got bang on that kind of biting point where like you want to prompt players up to a certain point and give them solutions and ideas to, you know, past that point. But like I think you do a really good job of like saying like, here's a bunch of stuff, you can mix it together however you like, but the result is up to you and your players. And I think that's, for me, that's what RPGs are for, right? They're kind of engines to make stories collaboratively, and I think Teeth does such a great job of that. Might be a good point to bring in Chris, actually, because Chris, I might keep blowing smoke.
Oh my god!
Because for listeners who aren't familiar with Chris's podcast, you and Chad have been doing it for like a very long time, right?
15 years.
15 years of the what was previously the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast, and is now Strange Studies. I can't recommend that podcast enough.
Thank you.
I think Steve Doherty, the video game writer, said one of the problems with podcasts is you have to decide whether to go in early when they haven't worked out how to use their recording equipment, or late when it's all just a bunch of in-jokes and you don't understand what's going on. And one thing I would say about Strange Studies is that you can listen from episode one and it's great. And it's you guys going through the H.P. Lovecraft stories, which you run out of very quickly and have been doing.
There's not many.
Other stuff since then. And now you've rebranded as Strange Studies, which has kind of opened your horizons a little bit, and that's been wildly entertaining. And now you're working on an RPG of the same name.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's called Strange Stories, the game, or the role-playing game. We haven't decided yet, but it's focusing on short scenarios, one-shots, because especially with kids, I know that's something that Jamie has had to deal with. But once you have kids, being able to plan gaming sessions that reoccur at any regular interval has been difficult. And just being able to game and do a one-shot game. You were talking about Mothership. I've been actually really enjoying Mothership, but we play it as one shots. We don't use the same characters. One, because I think the fatality of most of them, but also it just doesn't make sense for the stories to have those same characters within them. The guy that's been running them uses the pre-published adventures, which are fantastic. There's one of them, I'm going to spoil it. I won't say the name of it in case somebody ends up playing it, but it's basically a Groundhog Day scenario where time loops and it resets and you have to figure out the solution to the problem, and then it resets again. And it's, we haven't finished it. We're right in the middle of it right now. And it's fantastic. I can't tell you how much fun it is. Like, there's a few games that I could pick out from my memory of that I've just absolutely loved. And I remember I went upstairs after we were gaming, and I said to my wife, I'm like, oh my God, we're playing this game, and it was this and this. And she's like, you're so excited. You're so excited. I'm like, because it was fantastic. It was amazing. And there's few games that are like that, that where they have a hook and the hook catches you and everybody's just gelling off each other and everybody's on the same page. And I don't know about you guys, but gaming online is a bit of a boon and a curse. both at the same time, I find that it can get really boring if people aren't focused. Everybody, because you're on a computer, the internet's right there. And you know, half of those players, when people are talking, are looking, checking their mail, looking at websites, doing stuff. And it's, including me. And it's one of those things where I can game with people all over the world, which is fantastic. But it's not the same as gaming in person, and you don't have that energy. So finding a game where everybody's excited and jazzed about it, and that particular scenario of Mothership, everybody was just, I could see everybody's eyes were lit up during that session, which is fantastic. It doesn't happen very often.
We really want to do that one. It looks quite intimidating, I have to say, to run it. But I mean, that's a really interesting module for you particularly, because it is almost like a sort of a strange stories. Your game is all about kind of recreating those kind of spooky Outer Limits strange stories, and like a time loop episode feels like that would fit perfectly.
It would fit perfectly, and I really want to rip it off. But I mean, it is a rip off of so many other things. Oh, you know, yeah. There was Groundhog Day, and then what's the Tom Cruise Day After Tomorrow?
Edge of Tomorrow.
That's it. Edge of, and then there was Palm Springs, the Adam Sandberg movie, which was actually pretty good. But the idea is not new, but having it 50, as a role.
50 First Dates.
50 First Dates?
The Adam Sandler movie.
But it's for a role-playing game, it was the first time that I thought of it as a role-playing game. And it was just because I think that idea is so familiar to all the players, everybody just jumped right into it. So I thought that was really good. But speaking of my game, we're still in the playtesting. And we're working through we're going to have three scenarios or short stories, one science fiction, one fantasy, one horror. And that's where we're going to launch, hopefully, a Kickstarter next spring, if everything goes according to plan. But we're in the second phase of hardcore playtesting. And then after that, I think we're going to be pretty settled.
And me and Marsh played in an early playtest, which was
you did.
A very entertaining and hilarious evening.
I think I had turned into Biden at the end of it. You did. I'm not quite sure.
You did.
ended in a place when one could not have predicted, having gone into it, which is the best kind of role play experience, I think.
Well, I mean, it really supported my style of play, because if I'm linked with the wrong players, I can really fuck people off, because I love trying to break the game. And I love
I wouldn't say break the game. I would say you're breaking it.
No, I like to narratively jump in with both feet and really have fun.
Yeah.
And I think, I think generally it's good fun to play with, right? I hope. Anyway, and I, you know, when I play Teef and when I was DMing Teef, that's how I kind of really encourage my players to play as well. Like, because like as I say, that is the form of tabletop role-playing game, which I think is the best.
I feel like there's two major styles of role-playing games. There are people that are more narrative, which I think Jamie and myself fall into. And then there's what I call the simulationist. These are the people that like to have a setting with a character that can do a specific thing. And they like to live in that world and see what it's like. And they want it to be as real and consistent as possible. Even if their characters die, they don't care. Or if it's a boring story, it doesn't matter to them. And I think there was a phase where I did play games. Call Cthulhu. I remember back in the day, there was a Call Cthulhu session where we just called the police, like right away. And it was short. It was really short. I remember it was a house. The police went in. One of the police, only one of them left. Then the state police came in. One of them left, you know, ran away. And then the National Guard came in. And then we were just, we had no idea how it ended. That was, and I remember the lack of satisfaction that we all had as players. The guy that was running it, my friend Lyle, intentionally didn't give us any answers, and we're like, well, so what was going on with us? And he goes, I'm not telling you.
Yeah
You didn't earn it. Didn't earn it. The police know, the National Guard and the FBI, they know. So
that's very Lovecraftian, isn't it? If you just ignore the call of Cthulhu, you go somewhere and do something else. That's great. I'd love to ask you, Chris, actually, like, because you're a tad older, I think, than me.
I am. Yeah. I'm 51.
Spicy. And so you've, like, I know you were, like, I think maybe Call of the Cthulhu role-playing game was, like, your introduction to Lovecraft, right?
Yeah, it was. That's right, yeah.
I'm just kind of interested, because, like, Jim, on the previous tabletop role-playing game, sort of told his origin story with this stuff. I'm kind of interested in what yours is, really.
Well, I got into role-playing games because my dad played Dungeons & Dragons at church. The guy, we were Lutherans, and the vicar was into D&D. Of course, I never heard of it. So I went with my dad, and they were playing D&D, and I must have been 8 or 9. I was pretty young. I was hypnotized by it. I thought it was the coolest thing. The little miniatures, they were drawing maps on the table. And it was all this. So this must have been about, like, I want to say, like, 1981, somewhere around there. And my dad bought the purple box. So that was the box set that came out in 1980. And he had it. But my dad wasn't really into it. It was just something that people were doing. And then he didn't do it very often. But
was
I
it
had
like
that...
Was it like Jesus-y D&D, or was it just...
Oh, no. Just God, D&D? No.
No.
No, no. Straight up D&D, brutal, you know, demons, all that stuff.
So there was no kind of, like... Did the satanic panic thing mentioned at all? Or?
No, it didn't get... Well, 80... I think this is before that. So, like, 81, 82, I don't think the satanic panic was... I think that was more to, like, 84, 85. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, you are.
But
right,
I remember... Because I talked to that guy who was the vicar years later when I was a gamer. And I'm like, what's up with all this stuff? And is it compatible with religion and faith and all of those things? Because I was somewhat still religious at that point in my life. And he was like, no, it's a
D&D
story.
D&D ruined that for you.
He said it was a story. It's a story just like, you know, Lord of the Rings is not satanic. It's not. No, no. You're just telling stories together and having fun, and there's no harm in that. There's nothing wrong with it. And that, you know, I for me, that was what I needed. But from there, I played games like Marvel Super Heroes, the TSR one. I played Gamma World, Star Frontiers. Those were the things that I really started off with. And once I took my dad's basic box set, I remember trying to run it for my friend and his mom. So I must have been like 10 years old or 11 or something like that. And I didn't understand the rules. Those old D&D rules were like stereo instructions. They were so hard to figure out. And I just remember making stuff up, but everybody had a good time. And then that's what was important. And that's what kind of kept me going with that. It wasn't until high school that my friend Jason Woodburn.
Oh, look.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. Star Frontiers.
Jim has revealed to our webcams that he has the box set of that.
My friend Jason Woodburn, because he played D&D, he's slightly older than me. So he's like two or three years older. And when you're that young, that's a big deal. He was like, oh, he played D&D. And I'm like, yeah, because you ever play Call of Cthulhu? And I'm like, what's that? He goes, oh, man. So you play librarians and historians that see some monsters and they go insane or they die horribly. And I was like, what? Like, well, that doesn't sound like fun. And he goes, oh, it's fun. And then he was right. It was totally. But I think, like, that.
Welcome to the rest of your life.
I still game with Jason, the guy that introduced me. He's in my Sunday night group. I've been friends with him forever. But I think Call of Cthulhu was sort of my gateway going from a simulationist game into a more narrative game, because in Cthulhu, you know, you're not going to win. Even if you solve the mystery, it's not really ultimately going to work out for you. And that was okay. In fact, that was fun. And then once you accepted it, you just sort of, like Jamie does, you just go in feet first, you go nuts. And I think that was a big turning point in just role-playing games in general, with when people started really getting into Call of Cthulhu in the early to mid 80s.
Are those games the sort of the mechanical blueprints for what you've come up with in Strange Stories?
No, I've sort of borrowed from a game called Broken Compass. It uses a mechanic of D6s. You roll a pool of D6s and you're looking for matching numbers, but the value doesn't matter. So if you get a pair, that's a simple success. If you get two pair or three of a kind. That's a double success, and so on and so forth. Just because, you know, I hate to count things. That's too much work. You know, like adding numbers and things together, I don't like that. And so if you could just look at a bunch of dice and go, oh, those two look the same. Those two, okay, there we go. It was a simple system, and I like to focus on story and characters and narrative. And I thought it was just the right kind of different mechanic, because there's a few things you can play with having rerolls and that type of thing with the mechanics. But generally, I feel like I can work with any game mechanic to make a good game. I mean, how do you feel about that, Marsh?
I don't know that I'm that adaptable. I don't know. We've been through a few systems now, and the ones that speak to me are the ones where, like, there's a real reinforcement of the narrative through the way that the dice work. I mean, the thing that we always come back to is, like, the way that Blades has great gradients of success and success with complications and things like that. And that feels very fitting for the kinds of narratives that you end up having. And it's all expressed through the mechanics of it. I don't know that we've played any kind of completely loose systems where it's just all on the players to kind of construct their own narrative, and the dice rolls don't matter at all.
Wait a minute.
No. I'm not saying that that's what you're doing in Strange Stories. I'm just saying, as the kind of the polar opposite of what we've been getting into, I don't think we've done any of that. Is that what the kind of the OSR, the old school revival stuff is about?
I'm not sure, really. I think they like simple rules and things like D&D. I'm running Dungeons and Dragons. So my barber came to me and said, oh, you're into that stuff. You like games and things. Do you play Dungeons and Dragons? I'm like, oh, I have played Dungeons and Dragons, but I don't really play Dungeons and Dragons much. And he goes, well, I really, really want to play. And any person that's excited about a role-playing game, I can't say no to that. And I go, well, we have these other games. And he goes, oh, but I've got all these people that want to play Dungeons and Dragons, because obviously it's the most popular game. It's what everybody knows. So I said, yeah, you know what? I'll run D&D for you. And he goes, oh, great. And then he texted me later and said, oh, I've got about 30 people that want to play. And I said, awesome. But it's like maximum, I would say 4 people can play. Yeah. Maybe 5 is pushing it. But there's this enthusiasm. So these guys were super excited, and I've run a couple sessions for them. 6 ended up showing up, obviously. And it's interesting because as I'm running with them, they're realizing the limitations of Dungeons and Dragons. Hmm. Like we had, you know, there's a combat, and when you have 6 people playing, their turn, they roll the dice and fail. And it's like, right. Oh, that sucks. That's not fun.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, yeah. It's not fun. That's the problem with this game. This is one of the things.
It's not really a matter of like rules maximalism versus rules minimalism. It's about whether the rules express the kinds of story that you want to create.
And, exactly.
And Dungeons & Dragons is great at what it does, which is that you go into dungeons and you hit things. But like, does it, I mean, there's a lot more you can do with it, but do the mechanics themselves express that kind of hinterland? And I think you end up kind of hitting quite quickly against the limits of how you can express yourself in Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
Without quite a lot of effort on your part.
I would say as a counterpoint to that, like the thing that got me into DMing was watching Matt Colville videos on YouTube. Like, and his like running the game series is brilliant. And
yeah, he's great. He is great.
He's fantastic. And in the first video in that series, he just starts with like, here's how an adventure starts. And he just gets into it like that. And then that video, that series is like hundreds of videos, not now. And it gives you everything you need. And he's kind of interesting on this actually, because he talks about how Dungeons and Dragons is kind of, it can express a lot, like more than people give it credit for, is kind of what he says. He's kind of speaking, I think, to people who make other games and play other games and feel a bit disdainful about Dungeons and Dragons. And it's certainly, like, I have no desire to play D&D personally. But he's quite convincing about how, yes, the vocabulary of it is kind of the trappings of epic fantasy or fantasy in general and dwarves and and all that sort of gribbly stuff. Mm-hmm. But actually, once if you use that language and that and those kind of tropes in the right way, you can tell a real multiplicity of stories that kind of can actually be quite expressive and kind of and diverse in theme and goal and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. I guess I think what I'm trying to express is that feels like a storyteller coming to D&D and telling a story and also playing D&D as a kind of aside. Whereas like I feel if you play D&D, those mechanics are always going to pull you back to certain kinds of directions. Like you're always going to be involved in acquiring loot. You're always going to be involved in power leveling, or what's the word for it?
Power gaming.
Yeah. You're always going to be aiming to kind of become better and more powerful over time. And that's not necessarily what all stories are about or should be. And in fact, Teeth, for example, is about becoming worse and more benighted over time in some ways. And although, if you're a skillful storyteller, you can come to literally any system and through the power of your storytelling, tell a great story. But that's not necessarily that. Then you're not really comparing system with a system. You're saying any system in the hands of an extremely gifted GM can be brilliant. And it can, of course.
Yeah.
No, and I think even like Matt Mercer himself has said Critical Role has had, a kind of slightly double-edged sword impact on people at the table, because people see Critical Role and they think, oh, we can recreate this at home. But obviously, he's being paid an immense amount of money to do it and really experienced and kind of everyone incredibly photogenic and all that sort of stuff, like in ways that most of us can't quite achieve.
Sure. How dare you?
And I'm sure he's preparing for these games like a job, because it is a job. So everybody else that runs Dungeons and Dragons or any tabletop role-playing game, they're doing it as a side thing. It's for fun. That's his job. He better be flipping good at it. I think trying to put yourself up to that standard is kind of preposterous.
But then I talk to people all the time who say, oh, you're writing these books, you're playing these games. How do you have the time? And because their experience is from D&D, and they like, oh, I've got this group, which we could have the time, but we're all professionals, we've all got kids. And I'm like, yeah, me too. And the way we do that is I play systems where I don't have to do any prep. Yep. So I can just turn up and go, oh, what's happening? Okay, roll some dice, off we go. And that works. You can do that with D&D, but it is so hard and you need to be so good and you need to have a bunch of encounters up your sleeve that you just know. And I ran two simultaneous D&D campaigns at one point and I was spending a day prepping to do that.
It's crazy because I haven't played D&D in years, and it's fifth ed. I'm doing the Minds of Phandalfr, or it was the box set adventure, which is really good. And I ran it when it first came out. But the characters are so complicated. They have so many different, even at level one, all the things you need to remember for what every, like clerics, how many spells can they do? How many have they prepared? How many slots do they have? Like all this, it's like, how are you supposed to tell a story when you're trying to keep all of this stuff in your head? Like it's too much work, and you want to have fun with these things. And we're talking about mechanics. I think the mechanics that D&D don't lend to good storytelling. You could be a good storyteller and use D&D, but you have to house rule the hell out of it to make it where it was easy and accessible to people. Like one of the things, as people were playing in this, and I saw the look of sadness on their face where they would roll their dice and fail after they waited 20 minutes for their turn. And it's just like that sucks. There should be something. And one of the players even said it, who never played a role-playing game before, goes, well, I feel like something should happen. And I'm like, yeah, I agree. Something should happen. And we can change the rules. I would be more than happy. I've got a few ideas. We can do this. We could have automatic damage, or we can have it where if you miss, you take damage. You know, there's all these different things we could do to kind of keep things more exciting so that it's not just a whiff on your turn. But that's not the rules of the game. That's not how it's written. We would have to change it to make it into something that we would like do. And everybody house rules Dungeons and Dragons. I haven't met anybody that doesn't.
Well, it's unlike all the, I mean, I haven't actually watched really any Critical Role at all, but I've seen other actual plays of Dungeons and Dragons games. And there's a huge amount of sort of kayfabe involved in pretending to play Dungeons and Dragons while actually making an entertaining show based off right. a more fluid interpretation of the rules, let's say. And that's yeah. absolutely fine. Like that is, I mean, that's great, and it makes it more interesting to watch. But I wonder to what extent people who want to play Dungeons and Dragons expect a game which is based purely on what they've seen in actual plays, which is not the same thing as playing around a table. It's a game built for televisual performance when it comes to actual plays. I don't know what the answer is, but I wonder what the influence that has on D&D and what they're thinking about the rules should be for it in the future. I know Critical Role recently... Is it recently released Daggerheart, which is their own sort of? It's not D&D.
Playtesting it. Yeah, it's not D&D. Right? No, it's a completely different rule system. It uses a 2d12 dice system, and it's very narrative. And you were talking about Matt Corville earlier. He's got a game coming out as well. Yeah. That's D&D-esque, but it's different because there's, like we've discussed, a lot of problems with Dungeons and Dragons. I think I remember one of the rules in the new game is he says you always hit. Or you always do damage, or there's something where there's never a, so these things, these problems that D&D has are apparent to a lot of people, and the people that are most known for playing D&D are making their own games that sort of fix those things.
It's, I mean, I remember him also saying, like, you know, part of the narrative kind of joy of D&D is something that comes sort of later, like while you're playing. And I guess this is particularly true of D&D, like you're poring over your kind of equipment list and your stats, and you're kind of very lost in the kind of the churn of that stuff. And then he talked about how it's the stories you tell each other on the way home, the kind of, and there's something very romantic about that, actually. I find that quite an enticing prospect to kind of worrying less about the idea of narrative cohesion at the table, and then kind of bringing that, taking that home with you. I don't know. There's something nice about that. Although it's, again, it's not quite what I go for in games I'm in or games I DM. It's probably the opposite of what I go for. But there's something to that, right? There's something to there's a thing that video games sometimes do where you kind of you do something maybe in a kind of some sort of game with some sort of, you know, emergent system or whatever, where you do something without quite understanding it. And then you look back on it and you think, oh my God, that was awesome. Like traditional roguelike games are really good for that. Like where you're watching the ASCII characters hop around or whatever, and you're typing commands into your console on item or whatever. And then you're like, oh fuck, that was like a totally awesome thing that played out there, just in text form, you know?
There's this amazing thing about tabletop role-playing games that I've said before, and I think it is an art form. And I know that sounds kind of heady or silly, but it's this amazing art form where you're not only the creator, you're the audience, you're the observer. Hmm. So you're the writer and you're the performer, but you're also the audience to the experience. And there's nothing like that. So when you make a game, it's something that happens at that table and only those people experience. You're just doing it for each other, which is sort of this magical thing. It feels so amazing. It's something that obviously has captured my imagination when I was a kid, and I'm, you know, 51 and I'm still doing this regularly because it's so amazing, and it's hypnotic in a way that it pulls you into this, but it's special. And as a person who you know, I'm surprised by the success over the last, you know, 5-6 years with these games where people are watching other people play games, I am bored out of my mind. I've never seen one. There's a Dimension 20. I've seen clips of Dimension 20, which are pretty good, but I tried to actually just sit and watch it from the beginning, and I can't do it because the magic of the role-playing game is that you are a participant. You're doing it. And that takes it becomes this weird, like voyeuristic thing, which it doesn't appeal to me in the slightest.
I mean, that's how I feel about all sport.
Yeah, I do too. I do too. Absolutely. Yeah, that I love to play games and go out and do stuff and kick a ball around or throw a frisbee or whatever. But watching other people do it,
yeah, I don't even do that.
It's interesting, isn't it? That like there's this like slightly annoying idea, like the one of the reasons that like film theory, like one of the big ideas behind like film theory in the 60s, right, was that the reason like cinema has such an impact on us, right, and all of the cinematic forms of art, is because the way cinema works, i.e. replaying events on a screen in front of us, mirrors the way our brain recalls memories, right? That we kind of we play our own little movies in our heads in order to remember experiences or imagine things, and that cinema has basically emerged out of that kind of primordial urge to do that, right? And it's funny because that's a slightly wanky idea, which probably has some truth to it, but like role-playing games are much more obviously a because we see, you know, I've got a 2-year-old as well as an 8-year-old, and they role play together, right? It's one of the things that children do first that sort of shows their emerging character and their emerging understanding about the world. It's a very fundamental form of play. You know, they start off playing on their own, and then they play side by side, and then they play with each other and come up with their, often they call it in their child circles now, they call it small world play, where that's where they're kind of like, oh, what are you doing? Oh, what are you doing? Hello. And all that sort of stuff, which is exactly what we do at the table. We just roll dice to like, we just roll dice to make it seem like it's a more grown up activity. I mean, I know that's not why we do it.
No.
That's not why we do it. We don't roll dice to feel like, don't worry, we're big boys rolling dice. No, but it does get in touch with that side of ourselves, right? And there's something
absolutely
beautiful about that. And there's no way that's not true, what I just said. Like, it just has to be. Like, it just has
it
to
is.
Be.
It's totally true. But on the defense of dice and randomization of a game, whatever, maybe some games use cards or whatever you have, it's because the person, I think the game master or the storyteller of that particular thing could potentially have all this control. And by throwing in that element of randomness, they don't have control. So the story will be a surprise for them as much as it will be for the players. And you wouldn't get that. I don't think you would get that without some sort of randomizing element to it.
Well, you say that, but I played a bunch of diceless games a few years ago, and you do still kind of get the random element because you can't predict what the other players are going to do. So we played a game that was GM-less and diceless, but it has like essentially a playbook for each character. I think it had two playbooks actually. So you
what
were
game
like,
was it?
Thistle and Hearth. It was called. We did write it. I wrote it up on the newsletter, and it was that you were playing a village. And you had both the characters in the village and forces that acted on the village, such as the wild and the winter, and you had a bunch of possible things that could happen on the playbooks, and they would be activated by certain situations coming up. And so you could see what situations might come up from looking at the playbook. And you couldn't tell what was going to happen because other people were taking actions and sort of taking moves within the game, like narrative moves within the game, and it was a very strange experience because it was nothing like the RPG stuff that I'd played before, and it skipped any of the sort of dice stuff, but you still got this element of randomization because you couldn't predict how another person was going to then pick up that story and that idea and that kind of potential narrative thread and then do something. And then these playbooks ended up getting passed around between the group depending on the sort of situations and conditions that were triggered by people deciding what events were going to happen in the story. I don't think any of us played that correctly. Like, I don't think anyone who played it really understood what they were doing or supposed to be doing. And it was really interesting to watch three of the people in the group were regular GMs, and they struggled with it more than the person who wasn't, because they were like, I should take over and tell the story and call for a dice roll. But they couldn't, because that wasn't part of the part of the game. And everyone came out of it kind of like a bit confused. But I think it was because we had a bunch of expectations built up by how we'd already played games over the years, and suddenly to encounter this GM-less and I played a couple of GM-less games since then that have been more or less successful. The last one we played was a sci-fi game, which, oh, now, man, okay, my brain is just an absolute sieve for these names. Again, I wrote it up on our newsletter. And it's one where you collaboratively generate the world together, so that you have this whole big session at the start where you are deciding, are there lightsabers in this world? Are there wizards in this world? Are there wizards and robots? And you start going through this. And then it has an enormous number of tables and events and so on that you can read through, and or you can just generate. As you play, you roll some dice, things just start happening. And then within that, I think we played with two or three players, and everyone was responsible for the direction of and the management of the story together. And that felt even more random than playing with a GM, because you were passing this thread between people, and people were making decisions that weren't in any way guided by, you know, one central storyteller. But it was really fascinating as a process. But I think we ran out of steam on it, and we ended up just not even finishing the adventure and moving on to something else. And I think it was because in a lot of those games, the GM is this person who has arranged to do the session, and they have like a sort of motive to tell the story and get it finished. And I don't think when it was on an even basis between everyone, that worked. And you also had people who were regular GMs kind of starting to take over, and then realizing that they shouldn't be in charge of what other people were doing. So I think there is an RPG. I mean, I don't just think there is an RPG universe outside of the dice and the sort of inherited structure that we get from D&D and the other sort of classic RPG structures. But they're definitely much smaller and weirder and harder to get your head around, I think, than the sort of system that we've inherited.
There's that wonderful game called, is it called The Quiet Year or A Quiet Year? Which I kind of recommend to everyone, really, it's wonderful, where you draw the map of a place, and it's got a series of cards that you draw, and you basically tell the story of a place that you come up with as a group over the course of a year. And at the end of it, the frost reapers arrive or something, the frost harvesters arrive, and you don't even define what that is, or you can decide at the table what that is. But it's the only game I've ever played where every single time I've played it, people walk away from the table with this like sense of like disquiet. It's like an engine for disquiet, which is really interesting. Like, you don't walk away from it being heroic because you don't play as a character. You don't walk away from it feeling kind of, it's not really a game that necessarily is conducive to banter or laughter even, you know, it's like, it's quite a somber, solemn experience, but like, there's actually something really evocative about it. It almost feels like you're all sort of performing some sort of ritual. And the fact that you're all you tend to draw on a big piece of paper while you're playing it, you know, and you're saying, oh, I'm drawing the mountains, here's the sheep, you know, here's this crazy guy who lives in a shack outside of town, and, you know, now he's gone mad and killed one of the goats. You know, this kind of, it kind of builds that sort of stuff around it. And it's one of those games that feels a little bit magic, actually, in how it's put together.
The GM-less thing that I was referring to is Ironsworn Starforged, which is based on the Ironsworn game, which is enormously popular. And the Starforged was a rule set that allowed you to do the same world generation and character generation and parameter of universe generation that Ironsworn did, which is an incredible system in the sense that you can play it solo, or you can play it GM-less with other people, or you can play it as a classic GM setup. Like, it's got that kind of tiered structure that's supported through all of the materials, which I found bizarre, but also really impressive.
Are there any other systems that are doing things that are interesting to you that you wish to steal, perhaps, or just play around with in your own home tables?
One game I'd love to go back to, but it's really hard to run, is a game called Burning Wheel, or The Burning Wheel.
Yes, yeah.
Which Luke is Crane? About... Luke Crane, yeah. Who doesn't necessarily seem like the nicest person, but never mind. it's an incredible game, right? It's about as rule-heavy as they come, probably, although I'm sure yes. There's more complicated games out there. And when I played it, I DM'd, but one of the other players was the guy with the brain who could actually internalize the rules. It's incredibly complicated. There's rules for everything, and you're actively encouraged not to house rule things, not to you know, re-roll, not to do anything like that. Mm-hmm. But the experience of playing it over the sessions where we could kind of keep it going, I mean, they were exhausting and they were kind of sweaty because it's so intense and you're constantly flicking through the rule book and you're kind of constantly kind of haggling over different things. But what it ends up being is this kind of extraordinary kind of engine for creating character, right? That's the thing that it's all about. It's all about the characters and kind of simulating people, desperate people in a kind of complicated political world. There's nothing quite like it. And those sessions were, yeah, like I say, just kind of amazing and intense, to a degree that was unsustainable, it turned out. And we only lasted a kind of few sessions. But whenever I've played in a game of that, that is like, it does feel a bit special in a kind of funny way. Because it is so like robustly put together. So like I'd love to get back to that one day and try a bit of Burning Wheel. I know he's made some other systems which are, I think there's one that includes mice, which are a kind of
mouse
similar
guard.
Mouse guard, yeah. And he's done another one which has got a little bit of Teef DNA in it as well, I think, which is Misfortunes and something like that, which is like simulates is all set in kind of French Revolution times, I think.
Ooh.
And it's about being miserable and getting your head cut off.
if we hadn't gone to pirates, I think I would have bullied Jim into doing something set in the French Revolution.
We did discuss that, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was listening to the Revolutions podcast at the time and was like, ooh, that's genuinely a horrible period of history. We should definitely do something with that. But pirates was more alluring.
I've been really intrigued by the various different stress systems that we've been playing around with. I don't know why this is so alluring to me, but I feel like having played Mothership and like there's some things about the way that Mothership deals with like sanity and stress and all these things that works really well, in that it kind of creates this ratcheting up every time you roll against your fear and you fail it, that check becomes progressively harder. I think that's a really exciting way of expressing, you know, the potential of your character doing something that you can't control as a player. I like that kind of tipping point. And obviously, it's very evocative of horror. But there's something about Mothership's execution of that which I find just doesn't quite hit it for me. There's too many words involved: fear, stress, sanity, and panic as well. And like, I feel like you could do something a little kind of more, I don't know, just like tighter and I haven't played the Alien game by Free League, but that has.
I think they did it very well.
That sounds.
I thought
really
it was good. What was cool about it is that stress actually helps you out a bit,
right?
Because you get, you know, adrenaline would be the narrative explanation for it, but it uses a pool of D6s, and then the more stress you get, the more dice. You roll stress dice, which can actually get you more successes. But if you roll the equivalent of a one on one of those stress dice, you have a freak out. And your freak out depends on how many stress dice you're rolling. So if you only have one or two, it's kind of a minor freak out. But if you've got five, six, seven, then you'll have a psychotic breakdown. it's a great mechanic. It works really well. And I think it does it a bit better than Mothership, because like you were saying, where there's a lot of confusing bits to it, where it's really simple, but there's also that, oh no, I'm getting stressed, but oh yeah, I'm getting stressed. I can actually get some things done here. How long can I get things done before it gets to that tipping point? And I thought it did it really well. Jamie's played it.
Yes, no, I enjoyed that immensely. That particularly, like, again, that game works really well when you're being chased around by aliens, and like that system works really well too. Less so when you're not. I would say with teeth, with teeth, the kind of mutations system where you could have kind of bad mutations. I can't quite remember what the exact terminology was. But my players love that, right? They loved being given a thing which is like, your character now does this. You know, your character has to do that. And I, you know, when they were having getting players to narrate their misfortunes, I think is immensely fun. And like, I had a couple of players in our game who were a little bit hesitant, a bit more D&D focused players. I'm like, actually saying, no, go on, tell me, go and have a go. Tell me how your character gets its, you know, your eye torn out by a hogman or whatever. And like, you know, it's a really good way to get like players to kind of, it's a really good icebreaker, I think. To say like, no, you narrate this now, you do this.
I think those kind of modern systems like the Power Bar of the Apocalypse and Forge in the Dark and stuff, I think that's the power of those, because you're rather than reacting to a situation that the GM has laid out necessarily. I mean, there is some back and forth, of course, but it becomes more conversational, and it's a lot more, what do you want to do here? How did that happen? You know, and it's, you know, the agency of like the resist role, for example, you have to say to the player, like, how did you get out of, you know, you were on fire falling out the side of a tower towards the street. What happened? And they have to, you know, they have to invent that themselves. It's not you saying, you know, well, let's roll some dice and then, oh yeah, okay, this happened. They have to pony up and explain themselves. And I think I think that what makes that brilliant for me as a GM is I'm offloading lots of cognitive load onto the players and just sort of saying, no, you come up with it.
You get that wonderful moment where you sort of say, okay, so you get stabbed through the arm and then you stop yourself and go, oh no, actually, you tell me what happened. And that is one of the nicest feelings as a GM, because you get to like, you're participating, but you're doing it as a en masse, and that's a wonderful feeling, I think. Yeah.
It's been, and it was good playtesting an early version of these the rules we have for Gold Teeth with our very experienced Blades in the Dark fans in our own kind of home session, because they helped me, because I was GMing it for the first time since I was about 12. and they basically helped me through all of the things that were going to be pitfalls for me, because every time they were about to roll dice, they themselves would suggest what could go wrong. And that was just such a huge relief, because it meant that I didn't need to come up with all of that stuff on the fly. And it made it go a lot smoother.
Yeah, it's been interesting, actually, that one member of that group is someone who's never played D&D, never played any traditional RPGs at all. And the first game he'd ever played was Blades in the Dark. And he has taken to it just to an extraordinary degree. He always turns up, it's always very active. He's also, personality-wise, one of the quieter people in the group, but really takes it to heart and often comes up with the most devious and interesting plans. Often he's the person as well that comes up with something that's a sort of long arc, like in our original first Blades in the Dark campaign, he actually wanted to betray everyone. And did, and eventually sold them out to the police to become a cop at the end, and betrayed everyone. That was his long term plan, was to get out of his life of crime, was to sell out everybody else. And he worked on it for the whole campaign, and then executed at the end. And it was shocking, and everyone was like, and that was fantastic. And I tried to imagine if I'd have run D&D. And it had been, you know, the end of his campaign had been his paladin leveled up or something. It would not have been the same, I suspect, for his first experience of an RPG.
I really like in your game, Chris, because you're doing these one shots, you give the players the opportunity to like narrate their kind of their epilogue, you know, their kind of what happened next. And I thought that was really good fun. You know, we had a lot of fun coming up with stupid shit for our characters to do, like once the kind of credits had rolled, basically. That's a really nice way.
Yeah, that's a pretty good mechanic. I'm pretty happy with that mechanic. It works out because people have some strong opinions, especially at the end of the story, about how they think things are going to play out. And it's fun to be able to just hand that over to them for an epilogue.
Yeah.
Where there's a definite conclusion to the story, but then what happens after? What does that mean? And being able to do an epilogue kind of allows the player to tell everybody else what it means to them.
There's imagine Louie Louie by the Kingsmen playing. Well, it's like, you know, Jamie was sucked into a tentacle vortex and spent the rest of eternity in a hell dimension.
Yeah.
There's one thing I wanted to ask, actually. Chris, I know you've got kids. Jim, I don't know. Did you say you do have kids?
Two, yep.
How old are they?
11 and 14.
Right, yeah. So the question I have is about playing RPGs with kids, right? Because I have done a little bit with my daughter and she's really enjoyed it. There's one we've played, the name of it escapes me, but it's one of the kid-focused tabletop role-playing games. It's very simple and very good. But I'd like to do more of it. I think it's really fun. I think she loves it. She loves having an owlbear pet. And I wondered if you guys could talk a little bit to some of your experience with that. Chris, I know you've played a fair bit with your lads.
Yeah, my eldest, who's 12, doesn't like role-playing games. It makes him uncomfortable for some reason. But my 10-year-old is up for any game. He's just, whatever it is, he's excited about it. And he's good at rules and understanding rules. So he's not even, he isn't put off by heavy rules games. In fact, he kind of likes rules in games, but I like more narrative stuff. We're trying out that there's a new Arkham Horror role-playing game that just came out that's based on the board game Arkham Horror. Fantasy Flight's putting it out, and we're playing that. And that's for the beginner box. It's still somewhat rules heavy, and he picked it up quite a bit. And we're playing that with him and my wife. But I'm hoping that at some point he's going to think maybe my friends would like to play this, because he's got his friends, and I would like to run a game for him and his friends. And then maybe at some point he'll want to take the reins and run games for his friends and those types of things. But of course, keeping it simple and in just sort of indulging in what they like, I think it was what got him hooked into it. So we played games where, you know, he was a superhero, and I used just some really simple rules. Like I gave him an ability where he got to add a basic dice roll to a modifier, and then there was a difficulty number. And it was just something that off the top of my head, and he really loved it. And it was one of those things that pulled him in, like anything can happen. And I have got control over it to a degree, but then my actions have repercussions. He also likes that too, because he wants to, you know, if he can just do what makes stuff up, then it's not really that fun. But if you do something and it means something, like if there's a goal or problem and you're able to succeed at that thing because you can fail, then it means so much more. And I think he really liked that.
Hmm. Jimmy, your kids into it?
So my older boy refused to play anything with me. In fact, I bought the Atma system, which is powered by the apocalypse, but you have a bunch of cards that set everything up, so it's no prep. You deal with the cards out and they tell you what monster and what. It's really cool. But I ended up selling that on to somebody else who wanted it, because I bought it to play with him and he just sat there and we tried a couple of times. I was just forget it. And I think this was maybe contemporary with that. He discovered his friends were playing Dungeons and Dragons at a youth group organized locally by sort of youth services, and it was a room with several tables where there were multiple D&D games going on, and they spun that off to playing D&D online together. Now, and so he plays regularly without any real interference from me or any interest in my work or, wow. You know, like, okay, yeah. I explained to him how Forged in the Dark and Teeth and Stuff worked recently, and he was amazed. He was like, oh wow, that sounds like a real game. I'm like, yeah, it, you know, we did publish it.
It is a real game.
my daughter, she's much more interested in playing with me. She's a bit younger, and she's very sensitive and innocent and very law abiding. And we played Goblins, which is a sort of light D&D thing where you play a newly born goblin, And it's a bit gross and a bit silly, and you've got to get a present for the mother goblin that's given birth to you in the goblin spawning pools, and it's all a bit gross, Nikki, and she was a bit freaked out by it. But she had to get something, and there were some fairies in the way of what she wanted. It was like a saucepan in a lake or something. She was like, oh, that would make a great present for the queen, so let's get that. But the fairies were protecting it and were biting people that went near. And she said, well, what do I do? And I said, well, what do you think? You know, what would be around at a lake? And she said, oh, there's stones. And I said, yeah. And she said, well, I'm going to throw a stone at the fairy. And she hit the fairy and it fell into the water. And this kind of like mixed expression of like horror and also kind of, I can do that in this. And it's, you know, it's completely fine. So this kind of horrible moment of delight in transgression. And she's just been pestering me ever since to play from that, which has been, it's been really good.
I ran some D&D for a friend of mine and his three daughters, and they were, I think it was 10, 13 and 15 or something like that. You know, that was that age bracket, and they had heard about D&D. He had run D&D when he was younger, and he goes, oh, would you run some D&D for me and my girls? I'm like, yeah, sure. Let's do it. And they were the most bloodthirsty, heartless. I couldn't believe they killed everybody. They got it, and they loved it. The pure abandonment of any kind of morality was just at the top. You know, there was a bartender that just gave him some lip or wasn't quick enough. They killed him. They just killed the guy. They loved it.
Teenage girls.
Teenage girls.
Maybe the satanic panic was right.
Bring it around.
So what is next for Strange Stories? When do I get to playtest another module?
Well, I'm ready to have, I have two adventures in the poop chute ready to go. So for you and Jamie and Jim, if you'd like to join us to do playtest, but there's going to be a playtest that's available just to general public, hopefully in 2 months, right before Christmas. That would be great. And then we get that last round out just to see if there's any problems, but we're feeling pretty confident that we've got what we need. We just want to make sure that that's right. The art director, who's Graham Pilling, he's done all of our posters and our website redesigned and all that stuff. He's fantastic. He's right now starting on the layout of the book and everything. So I'm very excited to see what he's going to do, because he's really talented.
Awesome. I can't wait. I'll definitely sign up for it. Is it going to be do you have a pitch for the next module that you're going to test?
There's two. I'll tell you the titles. One is called tentatively Galaxy Patrol, and the other one is Monks versus Monsters.
Oh,
like it.
I do love a monk.
I love how that was the trigger word for you.
I know, yeah. that's excellent. Well, thank you for joining us on this rambling journey through role-playing games. That was very enjoyable. It's nice to talk about something that I love as much as role-playing, and I don't have that many places to express that publicly. So this was really, really enjoyable. In fact, I really want to go away and run something right now, but there aren't enough hours left in the day. No. So that's impossible.
Sadly.
Just to conclude on a second plug, Gold Teeth is kickstarting now. You can find more about it on Kickstarter. There's probably going to be a link in the show notes, but you could just type Gold Teeth into Google.
Awesome. I backed it already.
Oh, sweet. Do you have your own pirate portrait?
I don't think I've backed it at that point, because my wife's been cracking the expenditures on games lately. She's like, how much are you spending? I'm like, we don't need to talk to you. But thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it. It was really great talking to you guys. And it's always, like you said, it really does one's heart good to be able to talk about something that you enjoy so much with people that enjoy it as much as you do.
And where can people find Strange Studies, Chris?
Oh, you can go to strangestudies.com. It's a regular website. There's free episodes, or you can go on Patreon if you want to help us finance our show.
I go up and down on my various Patreons. You know, sometimes I unsubscribe to people and leave it a couple of months, I'm always a fully paid up member of
Yes. Yes.
I listen to every episode, even the ones I'm not on. You had Patton Oswalt on.
He was on recently.
So cool when he turns up.
He's a fan. He's a fan. Yeah.
Yeah. And your game will be likely kickstarting sometime next year.
In the spring. That's the plan. Yeah.
And we'll make sure to send up the pod hooter when that happens. And maybe you could even come back and have a chat with us about it.
That would be fab.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Try and stop me.
Well, that's it for this episode. If you'd like to see more stuff by us, you can find it on YouTube at youtube.com/CratenCrowbar. There's other stuff by us there. We're also funded by Patreon, but you haven't been charged for this episode because it's not our regular video game show, which will be back later this week, probably, depending on when I choose to put this out. Maybe it'll be in the past. Who knows? Anyway, you can back us too at patreon.com/CratenCrowbar, or you can join our Discord community. They are truly lovable, and the link for that is on our website, CratenCrowbar.com. That's it. I've been Marsh Davis.
I've been JB Britton.
And Jim Rossignol.
I'm still Chris Lackey.
Thanks for listening.